Welcome to a Thursday edition of Locked On Heat. On today's show, the Heat had their best scoring game of the season Wednesday night, beating the Knicks 110-87. We'll talk about how they did it.
And as Rodney Magruder continues to put up big numbers to start the season, should he be considered for the season's most improved player? We'll answer that and other Twitter questions from the game. Thank you so much for listening and for subscribing. Now let's get to the show.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
All right, let's do this. Welcome to Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, the only podcast that breaks down every Heat game, news item, rumor, and more. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm a credentialed writer covering the Heat in the NBA for FanSided. You can find me on Twitter at WC Goldberg.
And I'm David Rommel, a credentialed NBA writer who's covered the Heat and league at large for SB Nation and FanSided. You can follow me and my writing on Twitter at DRommel13.
The Heat beat the Knicks 110-87 Wednesday night, improving to 2-2 on the season. We'll talk about what went right and what went wrong before getting to your Twitter questions that you sent in using the hashtag AskLOHeat. And we've got the postgame pod for you today. After going into halftime with a 2-point lead, the Heat went on a 13-0 run to start the second half and scored 45 points in the third quarter to take control of the game. It was the best offensive quarter of the season for the Heat, who made 8 of their 10 three-point shots in the period after going 4 for 10 in the first half. It helped that the Knicks went from shooting 60% from behind the arc to missing all 8 of their threes in the third quarter. The Heat had 6 players score in double digits for the game, with Hassan Whiteside leading the team with 22 points, 14 rebounds, and 3 blocks. Josh Richardson tacked on 21 points on 8 of 14 shooting. Rodney Magruder added 19 points on 8 shots. This was the best the Heat have looked offensively all season, David. Is it as simple as the Heat were just making their shots?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a combination of factors. I think, one, the Knicks are really bad. They lack any kind of clear direction, particularly defensively. They're lacking their superstar player in Kristaps Porzingis, and that's fine. But they had played some tight games before. They just looked a little disheveled. Maybe we can chalk it all up to South Beach Syndrome, if anything. But as far as Miami is concerned, I really do think it was the insertion of Kelly Olynyk into the starting lineup to replace Derrick Jones Jr. As good as Jones has looked, I think the offense just runs more smoothly. I saw one of our listeners commented on Twitter about this looking more like the 30-11 stretch of the team. And I think a lot of that had to do with Olynyk, to be honest with you. Even though he wasn't part of that stretch, it was about the drive and kick game and the moving the ball on the perimeter and the fact that Kelly changes the way that offense moves. I think him being perimeter-based, one of the concerns I've brought up most recently is the fact that there isn't enough spacing on this team without a clearly designated shooter, one who draws multiple defenders or who has the gravity to open things up for others. But without Derrick Jones, who's more likely than not to drive to the rim, and having Kelly post up along the perimeter, that opened things up for cutters, for people to find easy baskets at the rim. And because of his great passing ability, that certainly makes things much more easy as far as open looks at the rim.
I mentioned the 30-11 stretch too, and it was more in regards to when the Heat went out there with Goran Dragic, Tyler Johnson, Josh Richardson, Duncan Robinson, who got his first run of the season, or the Heat's two-way player. It was his first regular season appearance. And then Hassan Whiteside at center protecting the rim. I thought with Richardson and Robinson spacing the floor and Tyler and Dragic driving and kicking and with Whiteside, you know, anchoring the defense, that to me had a very 30-11-ish feel to it. And Olynyk starting the game there also did the same thing. I thought in the first half he was a little bit more isolated, kind of just trying to stretch the floor from three-point range. But I didn't love the look of the two bigs lineup in the first half because it just still seemed a little clunky. I didn't love the spacing until they did end up going small with Duncan Robinson at the four. Spoelstra experimented with four wings at the same time. There was at one point had Dragic, D Wade, Tyler Johnson, and Rodney Magruder, I believe, out there all at the same time. And in the second half, decided to start the second half again with Olynyk and Whiteside in the front court. But instead of just kind of posting Olynyk out in the corner or above the break, had Olynyk do more James Johnson-ish stuff, where he was moving around a whole lot more, getting involved all everywhere from the elbow to sealing off screens in the paint and doing all the things that we were accustomed to seeing James Johnson do, while also doing all the things we're accustomed to seeing Olynyk do with the dribble handoffs and handling the ball from the triple threat position. So I really like the way the double bigs lineup looked in the second half. There's a lot of high-low action between Olynyk and either Whiteside or Bam. Olynyk played basically the entire second half, every significant minute until garbage time, basically. And I thought he had a much better game. At one point, at halftime, he went to halftime as a minus one plus minus. And then at one point in the second half, he was a plus 18. That's a 19-point plus-minus swing. That's huge. I thought it was a tale of two halves for Kelly Olynyk.
Yeah, and is that the biggest factor as far as what separates that two big lineup? Was it just a comfort level, or do you think that they just had Olynyk making different types of plays and getting him involved in different types of actions?
Yeah, I think that with Olynyk just kind of trying to stretch the floor and be. That stretch four guy doesn't necessarily work. Olynyk kind of has a little bit of a slow release. We don't really talk about that with him on that three. And as good as a three-point shooter he is at his position, defenses don't respect him a whole lot.
It's not, they don't, it's if a he's deliberate just, shot.
If he's not moving.
Yeah. It's a deliberate shot, I think.
Yeah.
One of the things that I got, I haven't talked about Olynyk a lot lately because I'm working on a piece about him. And one of the things that I got a chance to talk to him about, and a lot of players, Josh Richardson and Goran Dragic in particular, they both told me the same thing, which is kind of odd that, and actually Spoelstra said the same thing too, that when he first got to the team, a lot of what he did was kind of the fake and not necessarily, and then put the ball down the floor. And now they've had to convince him over the last season and now this start of this year to just let it fly. And I don't think he's quite comfortable there yet. I think there's just a part of him, being the old point guard that he was growing up, I think he still looks to drive to the rim, making plays for others. And he doesn't see himself as the guy who can space that floor necessarily. So I think there's still some kind of conditioning there that he has to work his way through, and he's evolved over time. Maybe we'll start to see less and less of that over the course of the season as he becomes much more familiar with that shoot first mentality.
I mean, he took 5 3-pointers in the game. He only made one of them, but he took five.
Right.
But Spo has said constantly he wants him taking 6, 7, 8 3-pointers per game.
Right.
So yeah, still some work to be done there. I think the more he shoots that, the better. I think he only had, I want to say he only had 1 or 2 3-point attempts in the first half where Duncan Robinson came in and had 2. Yeah, I think he only had 1. Duncan Robinson came in and had 2 in much fewer minutes than Olynyk. And I thought Duncan Robinson actually did a better job. That the offense looked much better with Robinson in there than it did with Olynyk in there. But in the second half, that completely flipped. I just think it was a lot of off-ball movement, a lot of what Spo designs and does best with all the off-ball stuff. I think that helped matters. We're going to talk a lot more about the game, but one thing that we want to get to, Chris Bosh made an appearance in the game. He was sitting courtside, spoke with Jax in the post-game show for the Heat on Fox Sports, and this was the first real big moment that we've seen. This is the first time we've seen Chris Bosh at a Heat game, really. The Heat honored him with a tribute video at some point in the game. Just really, really cool to see him on the sidelines.
That's phenomenal. I think the last time he did one of those appearances for TNT alongside Kevin Garnett and that, what is that called? The Arena 22 or whatever it's called. I don't even know.
Area 21.
Oh, yeah, well, sure. Something like that. Whatever that garbage is. I mean, he was sitting in front of a Toronto Raptors jersey. You recall that when he hung that behind him? And a lot of people thought that the relationship with the Heat was irrevocably broken. And I think it was because he was still under contract and they were just trying to figure out a way of buying that contract out. But it seems like he's taken steps to kind of heal that relationship. So, he still has a home in South Florida. I think he lives mostly in California and Los Angeles at this point in time. But to be there with the family, to be there with his wife and kids, to enjoy those front row seats, and then to see him still enjoy such incredible camaraderie. I mean, he had a really nice moment with Dwayne Wade there, but that didn't stop him from talking to all the assistant coaches. And then Eric Spoelstra in particular, I've rarely seen Spoelstra so emotional, right? I mean, he was just like, he was hugging Chris Bosh, and it almost seemed like he didn't want to let him go. Like, he almost like pleading to him, come on, put on the old jersey and come back out and play again because we could really use you. And that was really nice to see that. And you imagine that at some point, Riles probably spoke with Chris and his family because that's just what Riley does. He's very good at working with families and connecting on a very human level. And so you hope that relationship that we dreaded had been broken is now finally repaired, or at least in the steps towards healing. And this has been a really great year for that. I mean, there was a rough stretch there from 2014 and LeBron's departure and Riley accidentally, you know, slipping that LeBron and his wife were expecting. That awfully obviously ruffled some feathers the following year, you know, having these negotiations with Dwayne Wade. And then eventually Wade leaving again. All these things, you know, major, major PR missteps. And then, of course, the Chris Bosh situation. But finally, it seems like he's getting that back on track with Dwayne Wade re-signing. Chris Bosh still being a part of this organization in some capacity, hopefully in the future. That would just be great to see everything kind of healed and back to the way it was.
It definitely looks like things have been... There's been a bridge in the gap. And it was really cool. And I just... That Spoelstra hug from Chris Bosh was just... I posted it. I took a picture of my TV and I posted it to my Instagram account. It's rare that you can see that sort of emotion from anybody, especially Eric Spoelstra. And so we'll say this about Pat Riley. Still apparently some loose ends with Jason Williams. Apparently owes Jason Williams some money. So I think Pat Riley's got to get on that. But look, I mean, one player at a time, I guess. Dwayne Wade, now Chris Bosh. He'll get to Jason Williams in a bit. We'll talk about what went right and what went wrong next. But first, some housekeeping really quick before we move on. Our written Miami Heat season preview is available, and we've lowered the price to just $1. So go to gum.co/LOHPREV. That's gum.co/LOHPREV to purchase it or get it for free if you sign up as a Locked On Heat lifer at our Patreon page, patreon.com/LockedOnHeat. Also, if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, we have a special package to kick off the NBA season. For more information on how to be a part of Locked On Heat, email us at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com for details, and you can hear your company right here on the show. What went right for you, David?
Well, that third quarter, I mean, that might be an oversimplification, but I think seeing that offense move smoothly was certainly a big change from how sluggish it looked in the first half and the first quarter in particular, when things just weren't working well and there wasn't any kind of obvious camaraderie there. But I also like the aggression from some players that have had up and down games. Tyler Johnson in particular didn't finish with a blistering stat line, you know, only 10 points, but he was 4 of 10 from the field, 0 of 3 from three-point range, but still doing what he does best, you know, driving to the rim. John Crotty said so on the broadcast, and I think it was a really good point from Crotty, indicating that Tyler sometimes, you know, as some of the Heat players tend to do, gets in his own head a little bit, thinks a little bit too much about what he has to do and how he can contribute, and that aggression, unexpected burst of athleticism really catches defenders off guard. And I think we saw that from Tyler, where he was just driving to the rim, getting some good opportunities there, drawing fouls, you know, 2 of 3 from the line. Not great, but again, that's a nice welcome addition, certainly better than what we've seen from him over the start of the season. So that seems like a great change. And also, I liked Hassan Whiteside, you know, similarly aggressive, finished with a team leading 22 points, as you said before, 8 of 14. I really was worried about that matchup with Enes Kanter, but he seemed to understand in the second half the timing a little bit better. Kanter, as we talked about in our preview earlier on Wednesday, you know, he has really great footwork, a knack for scoring, and we saw that there were moments there where Kanter might be able to get off some of those, you know, low post moves to exploit Hassan Whiteside. And Whiteside was able to figure it out. He got a couple blocks on him and really just seemed to figure it out. And then offensively, just doing some really great work. I mean, had timing, not just with Roddy Magruder and a fantastic lob and catch, but also with Kelly Olynyk. That was a really nice lob from him as well in the low post. So that's really, really great to see that kind of aggression from those players.
Yeah, for me, I think just everybody contributing at some different level. Everybody kind of got a chance to play their game. You mentioned Tyler Johnson, Whiteside being able to get to the rim and stuff. And you know, he ended up with 10 free throws. And he went 6 of 10 from the line. In general, the Heat did a really great job getting to the line. They attempted 28 free throws, made 19 of them. And you compare that to the Knicks, who went just 9 of 14. The Heat got to the line twice as much as New York. And I think that was a big part of what they were doing there. They were aggressive. They were getting to the line.
Is this the first time a Heat player has gone into double-digit free throw attempts this season? Because I can't think so.
Yeah, absolutely. Impressive. And then Josh Richardson, quiet game. but for him, 21 points on 8 of 14 shooting. I say quiet game because we've been accustomed to Richardson scoring 21 points on 21 shots.
Right.
An efficient scoring game for him. So I think that was a major thing too. Richardson not forcing things offensively. That created more opportunities for guys like Tyler Johnson, like you mentioned, Rodney McGruder, who put up 19 points. He scored 16 points, I believe. Made his first six shots, had 16 points in the first half. There was a greater opportunity for almost everybody involved. And the ball movement was good to get those guys those opportunities as well. It was just an even offense. I think you've got to give some blame to the Knicks just being a generally bad team. But look, the Heat beat a bad team very easily. And so that counts. You know, that counts. What went wrong? Very little went wrong in this game, I should say. But we've got to find something because that's the point of the segment.
Well, to go back to Richardson, I want to thank Tim Hardaway's left elbow for kind of pissing him off, because that caught Richardson on the chin there, knocked him down, and I think Richardson just exploded after that, nailed 2 3-pointers and had a shot at the rim too, so he seemed incensed and energized after that. As far as what went wrong, it didn't seem like much. There was that first half there where things were shaky, but maybe against a better opponent, Miami wouldn't have been able to figure things out the way they did in the second half. Still, it's tough to kind of focus on that, but if you have to focus on anything, I'd like to say that Dwayne Wade did not look good. He hit that 1 3-pointer, finished 3 of 10 from the field for 7 points, but otherwise, just really looks a step slow. There was a shot at the rim there that normally Wade would have finished. He just doesn't seem to be in sync with anybody out there. I think he's still trying to figure it out. He played 26 minutes, almost as many as Tyler Johnson, almost as many as Hassan Whiteside, if you can believe it. And he just looked really, really, he lacks this explosion. And I think that's to be something to be expected at this point in his career, but it's still kind of hard to see there. And, you know, it's great that he still has the love of the home crowd there. And I think a lot of people will still respect him no matter how bad his game might look at this point. But it's still a little shaky and it's a little tough to witness sometimes.
I'm getting the sense early on in the season that I'm going to have to eliminate this segment, because I feel like it's just going to be a place for one of us to just complain about Dwayne Wade and just get depressed at some point. I'm just happy he's out there. Honestly, he scored his 1,000th point against the Knicks. I think that was cool. You're right. It came on the first shot that he made in the second half. It took him that long to get that first shot to go down. But for me, what went wrong was something very specific. The Heat ran an elevator doors action for Josh Richardson. Elevator doors, a popular play in the NBA, was more popular, I think, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And the Heat have never really kind of ran with it. Just, I don't think they had the guy that they could, they've probably done it a couple times with Wayne Ellington in the past. Maybe they did it with Ray Allen during the Big Three era. But
you want to explain it a little bit for our audience that might not be familiar with it?
Sure. It's when you put two bigs basically in the horn set, or something close to it. But as opposed to being spaced out completely on the two elbows, just outside the two elbows, they're nudged, inside the two elbows. So they're a little bit closer together. Basically, they're creating an opening between the two of them out by the elbows where one player's body can get through. And so they're essentially setting these down screens for a wing player, a shooter, to curl underneath towards the baseline and then back up through the quote-unquote elevator doors. Once he curls through, it's a timing play. Once he curls through, they're supposed to both take a step inside, and screening off the player's defender and any other help defense that would come with it, with a normal switch of a screen. And so that is supposed to result in a wide-open three-point shot right above the break. And so the Heat ran it for Josh Richardson, and you could see it coming because the Heat run horns all the time, but they never run horns where Bam and Kelly Olynyk are standing so close together, and I was like, this is elevator doors, and you see Richardson, darting towards the baseline and about to curl back up through it, and I was like, oh my gosh, they're running elevator doors for Josh Richardson. We haven't seen this before. I mean, I haven't seen it before. Maybe I'm wrong. If a listener has seen it before, point it out, please. But Richardson went in, looked like Bam may have stepped inside and closed the doors a little bit too early, and maybe, I think, got, touched hips with Josh Richardson, knocked Richardson off. Maybe the pass was delivered a little bit too early. Richardson didn't get the clean look. It's supposed to result in a clean look. Things got jumbled, but he ended up just running around the screen, back around the screen, getting to the rim and making a shot anyway. He scored anyway because he's Josh Richardson. That's what he does now, apparently. So
yeah,
a botched elevator doors play. It was cool to see it, and if I'm trying to find a way, something that went wrong, Spoelstra's going to go back to the film room and be like, let's work on this a few more times in practice. If we can't get it, I'll strike it from the playbook. But I want to get this. I want to get this right.
I'll flip it around a little bit and say the fact that they're even considering running this play with Richardson shows an incredible evolution and a trust in Richardson's game. You know, there was one play there that it wasn't even a set play where he was on the baseline and he curled back around and he went back out towards the 3-point line and curled back, picking up the dribble the whole time, and then was able to finish with a nice floater at the rim. That was absolutely beautiful. I don't know that we've seen that kind of polish from Richardson at this point in his career yet. And we're starting to see it more and more often. Look, there's still moments there where he's a little shaky. I think there's an adjustment period for him to be the lead guy on this team, the go-to scorer. But we're also seeing some really nice flashes. If it takes Hardaway's elbow or whatever the case might be to get him inspired, the more, the better.
Well, look, he didn't force things. And I thought there was a lot of, you know, off the dribble shots where he probably would have been better off passing the ball and keeping the ball moving. In the first few games of the season, that wasn't the case today. He let the game come to him. He didn't force things. And it turns out the Heat run a lot of plays for him, so he's going to get his shots, right? If he just lets the game come to him, he's going to be a much more efficient scorer, and I think this is a step in the right direction. Your Twitter questions are coming up next, but first we have created the ultimate NBA Twitter feed. It's Locked On NBA Net, and it has all the Locked On local experts on one feed. Every NBA team is covered. Every local angle uncovered. It is the ultimate Twitter follow for the NBA fan. Local experts on every team on one Twitter feed. How can you beat that? Follow at Locked On NBA Net for the ultimate NBA Twitter experience. For our recaps this season, we'll be answering questions that you send in on Twitter using the hashtag AskLOHeat. So let's get to some of them now. Jake LaFrance asks, this might be a crazy question, but does Rodney Magruder have a shot at winning Most Improved Player if he keeps scoring and contributing like he is? David, the answer is yes. If he is going out and scoring almost 19 points per game, yeah, he's the most improved player in the game.
So the answer then is, I'm sorry, I misread it. Well, let me go back. I think Jake's a new listener here, perhaps. There is no such thing as a crazy question. You can ask anything. We'll take it. We've answered questions about the Guardians of the Galaxy. We made a whole podcast on that, so there's no question too crazy for us to go into, but I absolutely agree with you. I think, I don't know what it's going to take. Magruder, or the most improved player in most of these postseason awards, has to do with some kind of storyline building. And I think it's kind of hard to picture that Magruder would kind of generate that sort of attention. But maybe if he improves his scoring to a significant click, maybe reaches some kind of, I'm trying to think. It's mostly going to scores at this point. Like,
it mostly goes to guys like CJ McCollum, guys who just like sort of make their natural progression. It went Victor Oladipo won it last year, and that was good, right? Like he had seemingly plateaued for 2 or 3 years, and then the narrative for him was all of that, you know, going to Miami, working out at DBC Fitness, and changing his diet, and getting leaner, and changing his body, and just, you know, fixing his hips, and doing all these things. And so that was a big storyline going through the year because people like me kept writing about it. And so I think that helped him win the award, because you're right, all these things are narrative awards. CJ McCollum, though, won it, I think, the year before Oladipo, and that was sort of a BS one. I love CJ McCollum, love his game. I think he's a star, but like he was a lottery pick. That was just like the natural progression of his career. He had never seemingly plateaued like Oladipo did. And so the most improved player thing is a little dicey. It's not my favorite award, even though I think it's a very valuable award. It's just not my. I don't think it's awarded the best way. But Rodney Magruder, if he goes from basically random scrub player to guy scoring, like, look, the question is, if he scores like this, which is basically 16 to 19 points per game, I think he has to get it. I mean, that's an insane leap.
Well, I remember back in the day they used to have the Comeback Player of the Year award. And I think that's the award that Rodney would qualify for best. And I think the most improved player, like the definition of what that award or who gets that award has changed so much over the years. But
yeah,
I think
Comeback Player, they got rid of it because it basically just kept going to guys who got injured for a season and then came back and had a decent year.
Yeah, but I mean, it fits perfectly. I mean, Magruder missed the whole season, and he's coming back looking like a legitimate scorer. And I think maybe part of that is the other teams just not being aware of that. So I wonder if over the course of the year, we'll start to see more teams respect Magruder, whether he starts to pop up on scouting reports around the league. Because, I mean, I feel like at this point, he's a legitimate player, obviously, and you have to take into consideration. It's not like you have to build your game plan around defending him, but you have to be aware of where he is because the dribble's so improved, because the, you know, the chemistry on pick and roll situations is improved, because he's taking step back three pointers and lobbing to Hassan Whiteside in the paint. I mean, this is that's an all around game. Not to mention
there's going to be a regression, right? Like we're expecting to be there will be a regression. He's not going to be putting up 19 points per game, but as far as being most improved, I love what you just. He's not just scoring more points, right? Like he improved. He used to be a catch and shoot, undersized three. You know, going back to that 16-17.
I would dread him putting the ball down the floor. I think I talked about it in last year's season preview. That's what I want for him, to see more of that. And now it's not just him putting the ball down.
He improved his facilitating. He improved his feel on the pick and roll. He's improved his feel of the game. He's been better defensively than ever. He's really improved. Let's move on. Miami Dude asks, so are we good with Kelly Olynyk now? What's our standing with him? I need answers before I sleep. So unfortunately, you're not going to get this, Miami Dude. But I don't know. Sorry. I put this in our show notes because I wasn't sure if you had done a couple of podcasts without me because I was busy in Chicago. But did you slander Kelly Olynyk at any point?
I never would. I don't think so.
No, me neither. I didn't think we are very pro Kelly Olynyk on this show.
I mean, it's not to say that he hasn't struggled. I mean, I think we've been pretty honest about that.
Has
I think he would. Yeah, I think anybody on that team would say, and I think the coaching staff would admit that he struggled to find his fit, you know, just so far. But he bounced back. Look, if it had been the tale of two halves that you pointed out before, we had just focused on what he did in the first half, you could continue some of that criticism. But at the same time, I think, you know, seeing what he did in the second half, you realize the value that he brings to this team. That passing, the ability to space the floor, the craftiness with the dribble for a seven-footer. I mean, those are elements to a game that we respect in so many players around the league. You look at a guy like Nikola Jokic, and it's not to say they're in the same level, obviously, but Jokic's craftiness and three-point shooting and passing, etc., has such great value as a floor spacer, and I think you can see some of those same things in Olynyk's game.
I think more than anything, Spo is good with Olynyk now because Olynyk played, I think, 6 or 7, maybe 8 minutes in the first half or in the first quarter. Spo yanked him, and then, like I said before, went to this basically four-wing lineup, and Olynyk didn't see a whole lot of action after that. But then went back to Olynyk to start the second half, and Olynyk bounced back, made adjustments, like I said, you know, stopped just being isolated in the corner or above the break and started just moving around and doing basketball things off the ball, and ended up being probably Miami's best player in the second half, if not darn near close to it. So loved Kelly Olynyk's game. I think he's back. I think it was just a slow, stumbling start. I think he just was maybe not sure of where he fit in on the offense. And I think he's figured it out if that second half shows for anything. So we'll see. But that's all we have for today. Thank you for listening. As always, you can reach us by sending an email to lockedonheat@gmail.com or on Twitter by using the hashtag AskLOHeat. And of course, make sure to hit subscribe on iTunes or whatever you use to listen to podcasts. Leave us a rating or review while you're there. Music is courtesy of Mojave Wild. Thanks for joining me, David.
You got it, Wes.